This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
I wanted to talk tonight a bit about one of the most central and perhaps most important aspects of the Buddha's experience and teaching that is referred to as anatta, or the doctrine or the truth of not self. Often in the suttas and the historical teachings of the Buddha, he refers to people who aren't practicing, who aren't studying, who aren't investigating their own minds, and or the suttas refer, who knows if the Buddha actually used this language, but the suttas refer to non-practitioners or as uninstructed worldlings. And statements like the uninstructed worldling identifies with the mind and the contents of the mind as self, or with the form and the experience of this body, the physical form, as self, or with consciousness, or that sort of witness consciousness. The uninstructed worldling, those who haven't investigated very deeply the nature of themselves, misidentify with consciousness or form or thought as being who we are. As being our identity or our self. I think for me, this process began right away when I started meditating. That the first kind of glimpse that I got into what I later understood to be anatta or not self was that my whole life before I began meditation practice, I had basically been obeying my mind. My mind and my emotions that arise in the mind had just been directing my whole life. Like whatever arose in my mind, I took personally, and I did all of the awful things that my mind told me to do. All of the ignorant and confused, and I had very little impulse control, and I was really deeply identified with my thoughts and my feelings. Before I began meditating, I had no idea that it was actually optional to do what my mind told me to do. I didn't realize that I had a choice or an option. Just my mind would say, lie. They will love you if you lie to them. Steal, cheat, whatever, you know, maybe not all bad advice, but mostly bad advice. And as far as I knew at the time, that's who I was. I am these thoughts. I am these feelings. I am this insecurity and this anger and this... That's who I am. And one of the first things that happened for me, and I imagine for most of us, when I began to direct my attention to the sensation of breathing, started the practice of mindfulness, and my mind kept thinking. But I saw through mindfulness of the breath, the initial instruction, for the first time in my life, I saw I can choose to ignore my mind. Which eventually led to the understanding that my mind has a mind of its own. Non-volitional thought continues while I'm paying attention to my breath, to my body. Have you seen that already? Like tonight, you sit down to meditate and you say, okay, mind, shut up. I'm going to meditate now. Stop thinking. Did your mind obey you? Maybe you're wise enough to realize that's not what meditation is, and that's actually not, I don't tell my mind to stop thinking, but often we come to meditation practice with that sort of idea of like, oh, well, I'll just stop thinking and I'll pay attention to my breath and I'll stop my mind. Or that was, for me, it was the first glimpse into seeing that perhaps this mind that I've been taking so personal, the contents of these thoughts, the emotions, the perhaps it's not as personal as I've been taking it to be. Because I thought that I was in charge of my mind. I thought I was my mind. And when I told my mind to stop, it disobeyed me. When I said, pay attention to the breath, my mind said, fuck you. I've got plans to make and resentments to rehash and fantasies to live out. I don't want to pay attention to the breath. I'm busy. You can pay attention to the breath. I'm going to think about pornography. And of course, in the beginning, I thought that that I was doing that. I was like, I keep thinking. But eventually it became more and more clear that these were unintentional thoughts, non-volitional habits of mind that were beyond my ability to stop. And as mindfulness got established more and more over the years, I began to see that it's actually not that much of a problem, and that there is a huge difference between volitional and non-volitional thought. Or intentional, I am thinking about this subject, and unintentional, my mind, these are arising and passing thoughts that are coming from nowhere and eventually dissolving again into nowhere. Part of the understanding of anatta, of not self, part of it, one way to understand it, and I think that we can all on some level understand and grasp, is that there is a impersonal and universal aspect of being human. Of having a body and a mind. And that it's not just my mind that thinks and judges and fantasizes. That this is just what the human brain does. If we gone unobserved, uninvestigated, we take it as self. That's who I am. I'm these thoughts. I'm these feelings. I'm this mind. Once we begin to investigate it, we begin to see, and especially in community, one of the beautiful things about Sangha is that then we get together and there's this kind of commiseration of like, oh, your mind does that too? I'm not sick? Maybe I am sick, but you're sick too? We all have this judging mind and this self-centered tendency and this tendency to take it personal, to think I am the contents of my thoughts or feelings or the cravings and aversions that this body generate all by itself. We get together and we say, well, what's your relationship to pain like? Oh, I hate pain. Me too. How about pleasure? Love it. Oh, I'm not a degenerate? It's not that it's not me. I'm not the only one filled with lust and attachment and craving. That's how it is for everyone. And so I believe that this is a part of anatta, of not self, of the universal human experience that's not personal, that is not self. If you have incarnated in a human body, you experience greed and hatred and delusion. It's just part of the package. If you're born in a human body, you also have the feeling of I am, often followed by separate, isolated. I am separate from, I am isolated, I am alone, I am lonely. But that feeling of I am, also through mindfulness, it becomes more and more clear that this physical form, this human body and psyche and mind and heart, maybe what we call heart, generate this feeling of I am, mostly based on memory and perception. If you start to investigate that I am, it's almost always in comparison to the past, I am here in this moment because I remember getting here. I have memories of the past. I have memories of who, you know, the experiences that have formed the present. If you don't consult your memory at all, who are you? Right now, here, in this present moment, if you're really mindful, present here, and you have to say, I am, I'm what? Do you even know your gender? Your race? Your sexual orientation? Any of that stuff, if you don't look at memory? I mean, maybe some of that, it's just, there's a knowing in the body of female or male or straight or gay or maybe. But it becomes more and more clear that most of what we are identifying as I is based on memory. Do you see this? It's not really I am, it's I was. I have been. This moment has come into being through remembering what has been in the past. I see some sort of phases in my own practice around relating to this experience of self and not self. And I've said this maybe to some of you before. Whereas as I began practice and reflecting on your own beginnings of practice, there's this often, for me, there was this very strong sense of I and me, and I am going to try meditation and see if it will help me. As a sort of self-help and as a kind of desperate attempt to not suffer so much. And it was like, I've stooped so low, I will try spiritual practice. It's that bad here in samsara that I will try spiritual practice. And then at some point, a turning point where there's a loosening of identification with the physical and the kind of not as much I in it, but then the I starting to identify with spiritual. Kind of going from I am a piece of shit trying to be spiritual, you know, I'm this confused person trying to be spiritual, to like an identification with like, I am spiritual. Kind of spiritual pride or arrogance or identification that then the self is identified with. Maybe I'm not this body. I've been meditating and watching my mind and trying to be kind and compassionate. Maybe this physical body and mind is not who I am. Maybe I'm a spiritual being, having a temporary human incarnation. And another identification, another self. Now maybe I'm not the physical self. Now I am the physical, I'm the spiritual self. And identifying with that, kind of taking that witness consciousness, I might be that which is experiencing this mind, this body. That's who I am now. That's my new identity. And then even that being shattered in moments of insight, in moments of concentrated investigation, where it becomes clear that even that is a conceptual delusion, a misidentification. And that when we are deeply present and investigating and clear with the impermanent nature of this unfolding self, that there is no solid, continuous place to say, that's me. I am spiritual. I am physical. I am consciousness. All of it is sort of memory and perception. All of it is concept. The closest I've gotten to glimpsing anatta is when I'm really paying attention. And the only thing that makes sense is that there is an unfolding process here. There are thoughts. There are feelings. There are sensations. There is memories and consciousness and perception. But there is actually no owner of these thoughts and feelings and consciousness and perception. I heard it explained once that made the most sense to me is that actually these thoughts are thinking themselves, this body is feeling itself, and consciousness is knowing itself. Completely impersonal. There's no owner of this experience. These are experiencing themselves. these are experiences of form and thought and emotion, perceptions and memories. And the body generates a "I am the owner." But mindfulness, deep investigation, makes it clear that there is no owner. There is only the body physically generated sense of "I am." And that the body generates that in such an impersonal way, like the brain generates thoughts. And it becomes more and more clear, anatta becomes more and more clear, that we are no more our thoughts or our bodies than we are consciousness or a self. Now, this is incredibly liberating, even if it sounds kind of counterintuitive and strange. It's incredibly liberating. It's so practical. Even just to have a glimpse of it, and I have to admit, I don't live in that place. I mostly live identified with my thoughts and feelings and body. But just having had the experience, having glimpsed it, understanding it from the inside, having insights into it, changes how we relate to I and me and mine. How we relate to our stuff, how we relate to our thoughts, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to each other. I don't think we have to strive too hard to gain insight into anatta, to not self. I believe that it is the inevitable understanding that is developed through insights and meditation practice. If you continue to deeply investigate your heart and mind and body, to really question this investigation, non-judgmental, non-identified, present time awareness. This is what happened for the Buddha, and this is what happens as we wake up. Another angle, I think, to talk about anatta, that's the kind of direct meditative experience of it. Another way to understand the doctrine, though, is that it's connected with impermanence. Everything is impermanent. You know that, right? Everything is impermanent, including the self. And I think that this is important, and a lot of forms of Buddhism have taken anatta and they've translated it as no self. Maybe you've heard that. There are forms, there are Buddhist traditions that say there's no self, or... And it seems like from the scholars, at least from the Theravadan Buddhist perspective, this is an incorrect way to talk about anatta. The Buddha was not saying that there is no self, because it's really clear that we all have the feeling of self. It's not that that doesn't exist. It exists. Do you have that feeling of I, me? It's not that there is no such thing. There is a such thing. But that self is an unfolding process. It's an impermanent process. Again, that is generated by consciousness and memory and perception and a body. A It's not that there is no self, it's just that there is no solid, continuous, permanent self. The self is impermanent. It arises based on the causes and conditions of a body. And if there is ignorance, then, which there is, then the body takes it personally. The mind takes it personally and says, I am permanent. Even now, sitting here, we all have this feeling, or I imagine almost all of us have this feeling of being like the same. Like, remember being a kid? And it still feels like, well, I was a kid. And the same self that was a kid has now, this body keeps aging, but that self, I don't know if it has aged much at all. And there's this way in which we have a delusion of a permanent self that was the same self when we were a kid, and now when we're an adult, and even when we are on our deathbed, there may continue with ignorance and identification to be this sense of a permanent self. Continuous. And part of that is not understanding all of the changes that that self has been through. That there is not a permanent self, there is an impermanent sense of self. Also, Anatta is pointing to that there is no eternal existence. The body generates, I am. The body is generated, and if we have to get into theories of reincarnation and multi-life, if that's part of this, the body comes into being because of greed, hatred, and delusion. When greed, hatred, and delusion are extinguished, when we're no longer identified and acting out of these taints, these unwholesome experiences, then we no longer take birth. Without birth, there is no self. Birth gives rise to I am. The end of the cycle of reincarnation ends I am. And so the self is not permanent. Now, this is a very different philosophical idea than almost every other tradition, even Indian Hindu ideas that talk about Atman, a kind of a permanent self that continues eternally. Or the Western ideas of a soul or a self that eternally heaven or hell. I think part of what Buddhism is saying is that you have a self until you do your work. And when you finish with the greed and the hatred and the delusion, main delusion, taking the mind and body as self. And when we stop doing that, we stop incarnating. Does this make sense? Sometimes in Buddhism we hear a lot of talk about emptiness. Everything's empty. Empty of what? Empty of inherent, permanent existence. These are some of my thoughts about anatta. Questions, comments, clarifications, please, Joe.
Are there any specific practices if you want to don't fully understand anatta.
His question was, are there any specific practices if we want to more fully understand, investigate this? Vipassana itself will do the trick. There are three main insights that happen through mindfulness, through vipassana practice, and that is that you see impermanence and emptiness in crystal clear. You understand it. You understand the unsatisfactory nature of pleasure and pain. Because you're with it, you see clearly that pleasure does not lead to happiness, and that pain sucks. And you begin to meet pleasure with non-attached appreciation, and you begin to meet pain with compassion, and then it doesn't suck as much. And you see, through vipassana, through mindful investigation of the four foundations of mindfulness, that there is no owner of this experience, that there's this unfolding process of being. Vipassana will take you to anatta. Probably the most direct route. In my own experience, I found it helpful because I was influenced by some, like my father, who was kind of Hindu Buddhist, and some of the Hindu practices that he did were like the Advaita Vedanta self-inquiry, and one of the practices that I did early on was the repeating question, who am I? And I found that pretty useful. It's not actually a Buddhist practice, but it was pretty interesting to just repeat over and over, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? And then at some point it became clear that it's not really the right question. It's more like, what am I? What is this? What's experiencing this? Who? Because, you know, when you begin to see through who, you say, well, there's actually nobody's home. Wes Nisker, my friend and colleague, he said, you know, the whole game can just be summed up in a knock-knock joke. Knock-knock.
Who's there?
Exactly. But sometimes that kind of direct inquiry into, well, who? Like in the end of our meditation tonight, even in the mindfulness, there is this feeling of I am. Where does it live? Can I find it? What is it? What is it? And it becomes clear, oh, it's consciousness and memory and delusional perception that takes birth as I. Please?
I was reading somewhere, it's just like same thing as Yogi Berra was saying. They were asking him what time it is. He says, you mean now. And the same thing with the I. You know what you mean now. The changes that you were saying.
Yeah. My father used to tell a story about the Sufi wild man Nasruddin, and he would, one time he went into a bank and he wanted to cash a check, and they said, can you identify yourself? And he said, pulled out a mirror, and he said, yep, that's me.
Hi, I'm Anthony, and I brought my sister here, so we're both here for the first time. And so I guess she's on my mind a lot, and she has a baby that's coming soon. And so I'm wondering, how would the concept of anatta apply to her unborn child?
Congratulations. I'm also pregnant. My wife is. We're about 4 or 5 months pregnant, too. It's a good question. I don't know the answer. The Buddha did say that these kind of things probably shouldn't be taught until the child is at least 7 years old. And we know this from Western psychology, that actually it's very important. Sometimes in the West we've said you have to have a sense of self like in the Western psychological, a healthy sense of self, in order to dismantle the sense of self. So it's actually very important for a kid to develop the I am and have boundaries and have a sense of individuation. It's an important part of the process. It's a natural part of the process. But then at some point we realize not completely true. So I don't know what to say about the infants or the unborn or other than they're in for the same ride that we're in for. And I have a 3-year-old right now, and it's so clear that like we haven't taught her to love pleasure and hate pain or to be really selfish. Maybe we have. But it's just born, right? Just born into us, this I am and I want and I don't want. And then eventually it's a survival instinct probably to have that I and that separateness. But Buddhism is interested in going beyond the survival-based mentality to a place of freedom, to a place of liberation, to a place of wisdom, of being able to deal with the feeling of I am with discernment. When is it appropriate to follow this desire, and when is it appropriate to renounce it? When is it appropriate to pull back from this pain, and when is it appropriate to meet this pain with compassion and not run from it? So that's something that the Dharma teaches us later after we've made all of our own mistakes. Please.
You talked about experiencing itself. But as long as there's a sense of subjectivity, isn't that part of the same delusional perception? And do you have a conception of Buddha mind, or something like this, that transcends individuality? And is that what continues in rebirth?
Could you hear him? I don't know. And maybe the answer is just yes. But I don't know. You know, I'm also struck by part of my lineage, Ajahn Chah, who was my teacher, Jack Kornfield's teacher, and Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Sumedho, he's this Thai forest Buddhist master. And he talked about, at times, he talked about become the one that knows. And maybe it was this that you're pointing to, the Buddha mind that knows, that has discernment, that not self, but that knows the arising of the feeling, the subject of self. Become the one that knows self as it is arising and as it is passing, as it is experiencing itself. But I don't know, it gets to be a little too conceptual, especially when we start talking about what is reborn and what is not. And I just kind of take the agnostic, not sure, when it gets there. Could you hear him? He said, with impermanence, in a free market society and system, would ownership create suffering?
For myself.
There was a time when someone asked the Buddha. He said, you know, I own a large business and I have a lot of employees and a lot of responsibility. He said, and I really want to be a blessing to people, and I see you own nothing, and you clearly the Buddha had a lot of responsibility, but you know, is it more blissful, is there more happiness in the life of a full renunciate than there is in the life of ownership and householder responsibilities? And the Buddha said, let me be clear that my teaching does not necessitate that anyone renounces anything except for clinging. you can own, you can have responsibilities. He said it is not power and money and things that destroy people. It is attachment to power and money and things. He went on to say, if you're better to throw all of your possessions away than to let them poison your heart. He said, but if you can relate loosely to your possessions, then you will be a blessing to people without the full renunciation. I've told this story a bunch of times. I have a 1964 Impala Super Sport Lowrider that was my car I wanted since I was a kid. I lusted after this car. When I was an adult about 10 years ago, I finally had enough money where I could go and buy the car that I wanted to buy. And then I was living in New York City and I had it in like hydraulics and little wire rims. And my mechanic had it and dropped it on one of those big plates, like, because it sets it on the ground. When they were driving it, it dropped and it tore the frame in half on my car. And I didn't suffer that much about it. And I love that car. And, you know, on some level, I'm attached to it, but I don't attach my happiness to it. And when it happened, I kind of said, of course, it's a material thing. It's going to get totaled eventually. It just happened to happen sooner rather than later. And so maybe the same with the signing the lease on this place or the mortgage on my home or whatever it is that we have, a responsibility to it and a showing up for it. And sometimes the consequence can be stress about it. But mostly a loose feeling of like, so if we lose the lease or if we lose the car, or if we lose the house, a deep understanding that I will be okay. My happiness does not depend on the lease or the car or the house. My happiness depends on kindness and compassion and generosity and how I relate to what's happening, not what's happening. And so I don't know. I'm not 100% in that place. But the more and more, I feel in integrity with the statement that that's my practice. Maybe only 70% of the time. I don't know how much. But most of the time, I feel like I can live with the responsibilities and the possessions without suffering about it. And sometimes I suffer about it. Please, Paul.
My practice convinces me that what you say is very true.
Yeah.
The more I observe, the more I see there's no permanent. It's just a bunch of things coming together. On the other side of that argument, I've also had experiences of, let's just say, encountering something that was not physical but seemed pretty conscious to me. And I'm willing to bet if you went around the room and said, how many people here have the experience of their consciousness being outside of their body or seeing something that you would classify as paranormal, at least 5-10 people would raise their hands and swear to you they've seen something.
Yeah.
So my question for you is, are you saying it's the Buddhist teaching that awareness is purely a byproduct of the brain, the way digestion is a byproduct of the gut, that there's no possibility of awareness existing outside of a physical living brain doing its chemical stuff?
No, I'm not saying that. Maybe I was saying that, but I think that what you're... I know what you mean. And it does feel like there is some part of consciousness that's not dependent on the body. I'm not sure exactly what to make of that either. Maybe it's, you know, what somebody was saying. Maybe that's part of what reincarnates, or I'm not sure. It does, to me, it mostly feels like the body generates I am as the identification with the consciousness. And mostly when you hear those out-of-body experiences, there's still the identification with I was floating above my body. So I'm not sure exactly how that happens, where the I am goes even beyond the physical with the... I don't know what to make of it. Not sure.
Well, I just wanted to comment. You know, I love this idea of reincarnation being translated as rebirth, and how it refers to this lifetime moment by moment. How is my sense of self, my I me mine, reborn moment by moment? And that being reborn into suffering.
Yeah.
And that I'm reborn because of my moment by moment in my life. I grip to my I because of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I don't know if that was Ajahn Amaro that I heard talk about that, but there is a school that does look at being reborn as a window into the grasping of self and the dissipating of self, the liberation moment by moment, the liberation from being reborn in this lifetime over and over and over again.
Yeah, I like that too. It's a much more tangible, or we can see that here and now. We don't have to get into the mystery of what happens after death. She's pointing to that sometimes it's talked about that rebirth is moment to moment rather than lifetime to lifetime, and that taking birth means being identified with I am. And that in the moments of seeing anatta and realizing that there isn't a permanent self, that's a moment of liberation. I think it was that Thai forest master from the south of Thailand, what's his name? Buddhadasa, Bhikkhu Buddhadasa, who talked about everyday, ordinary moments of nibbana. And all of those moments during the day, or especially for practitioners, where you're not self-centered, where you're not clinging or aversive, where you're not identified, and that those are little moments of liberation. And then in the moments when we're clinging, it's another birth, that's another attachment, that's another sense of incarnating as aversion, or incarnating as clinging, or of whatever thought stream. I like that thought.
Or incarnating as, this is Susan and I am right.
Yes.
And even if it is lifetime to lifetime, this feels right to me in this lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I see myself do it.
Yeah.
You know,
I think we will leave the discussion there for this evening. I deeply encourage you to investigate this teaching for yourself, to not take it as a philosophy or a belief system, but let your mindfulness, let your meditation, let your practice unfold with this as part of. I don't even think you have to think about it that much, because it will become clear to you if you practice mindfulness in a continuous and ongoing way, and especially if you do some deeper concentrated retreat time. Some of this self stuff is so pervasive that it takes the concentration and silence of a silent intensive retreat period to begin to break from the identification. So I encourage you to do some retreats and to find out for yourself who you are or are not.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.